Man's mutant was another man's genetic variant. A winter's night might choose one fly. A summer's day might choose quite another. Neither variant was morally or biologically superior. Each was just more or less adapted to a particular environment. And finally, the relationship between an organism's physical or mental attributes and heredity was much more complex than anticipated. Eugenicists such as Galton had hoped to select complex phenotypes, intelligence, height, beauty, and moral rectitude, as a biological shortcut to enrich genes for intelligence, height, beauty, and morality. But a phenotype was not determined by one gene in a one-to-one manner. Selecting phenotypes was going to be a flawed mechanism to guarantee genetic selection. If genes, environments, triggers, and chance were responsible for the ultimate characteristics of an organism, then eugenicists would be inherently thwarted in their capacity to enrich intelligence or beauty across generations without deconvoluting the relative effects of each of these contributions. Each of Dobzhensky's insights was a powerful plea against the misuse of genetics in human eugenics. Genes, phenotypes, selection, and evolution were bound together by cords of relatively basic laws, but it was easy to imagine that these laws could be misunderstood and distorted. "Seek simplicity, but distrust it," Alfred North Whitehead, the mathematician and philosopher, once advised his students. Dobzhensky had sought simplicity, but he had also issued a strident moral warning against the oversimplification of the logic of genetics. Buried in textbooks and scientific papers, these insights would be ignored by powerful political forces that would soon embark on the most perverse forms of human genetic manipulations.
Transformation. The reconciliation between genetics and evolution was termed the modern synthesis, or grandly, the grand synthesis. But even as geneticists celebrated the synthesis of heredity, evolution, and natural selection, the material nature of the gene remained an unsolved puzzle. Genes had been described as particles of heredity, but that description carried no information about what that particle was in a chemical or physical sense. Morgan had visualized genes as beads on a string, but even Morgan had no idea what his description meant in material form. What were the beads made of, and what was the nature of the string? In part, the material composition of the gene had defied identification because biologists had never intercepted genes in their chemical form. Throughout the biological world, genes generally travel vertically, that is, from parents to children, or from parent cells to daughter cells. The vertical transmission of mutations had allowed Mendel and Morgan to study the action of a gene by analyzing patterns of heredity. For example, the movement of the white-eyed trait from parent flies to their offspring. But the problem with studying vertical transformation is that the gene never leaves a living organism or cell. When a cell divides, its genetic material divides within it and is partitioned to its daughters. Throughout the process, genes remain biologically visible but chemically impenetrable, shuttered within the black box of the cell. Rarely, though, genetic material can cross from one organism to another, not between parent and child, but between two unrelated strangers. This horizontal exchange of genes is called transformation. Even the word signals our astonishment. Humans are accustomed to transmitting genetic information only through reproduction, but during transformation, one organism seems to metamorphose into another, like Daphne growing twigs. Or rather, the movement of genes transforms the attributes of one organism into the attributes of another. In the genetic version of the fantasy, twig-growing genes must somehow enter Daphne's genome and enable the ability to extrude bark, wood, xylem, and phloem out of human skin. Transformation almost never occurs in mammals, but bacteria, which live on the rough edges of the biological world, can exchange genes horizontally. To fathom the strangeness of the event, imagine two friends, one blue-eyed and one brown-eyed, who go out for an evening stroll and return with altered eye colors, having casually exchanged genes. The moment of genetic exchange is particularly strange and wonderful. Caught in transit between two organisms, a gene exists momentarily as a pure chemical. A chemist seeking to understand the gene has no more opportune moment to capture the chemical nature of the gene. Transformation was discovered by an English bacteriologist named Frederick Griffith. In the early 1920s, Griffith, a medical officer at the British Ministry of Health, began to investigate a bacterium named Streptococcus pneumoniae, or pneumococcus. The Spanish flu of 1918 had raged through the continent, killing nearly 20 million men and women worldwide and ranking among the deadliest natural disasters in history. Victims of the flu often developed a secondary pneumonia caused by pneumococcus, an illness so rapid and fatal that doctors had termed it the captain of the men of death. Pneumococcal pneumonia after influenza infection, the epidemic within the epidemic, was of such concern that the ministry had deployed teams of scientists to study the bacterium and develop a vaccine against it. Griffith approached the problem by focusing on the microbe. Why was pneumococcus so fatal to animals? Following work performed in Germany by others, he discovered that the bacterium came in two strains. A smooth strain possessed a slippery, sugary coat on the cell surface and could escape the immune system with newt-like deftness. The rough strain, which lacked the sugary coat, was more susceptible to immune attack. A mouse injected with the smooth strain thus died rapidly of pneumonia. In contrast, mice inoculated with the rough strain mounted an immune response and survived. Griffith performed an experiment that unwittingly launched the molecular biology revolution. First, he killed the virulent smooth bacteria with heat, then injected the heat-killed bacteria into mice. As expected, the bacterial remnants had no effect on the mice. They were dead and unable to cause an infection. But when he mixed the dead material from the virulent strain with live bacteria of the non-virulent strain, the mice died rapidly. Griffith autopsied the mice and found the rough bacteria had changed. They had acquired the smooth coat, the virulence determining factor, merely by contact with the debris from the dead bacteria. The harmless bacteria had somehow transformed into the virulent form. How could heat-killed bacteria debris, no more than a lukewarm soup of microbial chemicals, have transmitted a genetic trait to a live bacterium by mere contact? Griffith was unsure. At first, he wondered whether the live bacteria had ingested the dead bacteria and thus changed their coats, like a voodoo ritual in which eating the heart of a brave man transmits courage or vitality to another. But once transformed, the bacteria maintained their new coats for several generations, long after any food source would have been exhausted. The simplest explanation, then, was that genetic information had passed between the two strains in a chemical form. During transformation, the gene that governed virulence, producing the smooth coat versus the rough coat, had somehow slipped out of the bacteria into the chemical soup, then out of that soup into live bacteria, and become incorporated into the genome of the live bacterium. Genes could, in other words, be transmitted between two organisms without any form of reproduction. They were autonomous units, material units that carried information. Messages were not whispered between cells via ethereal pangenes or gemmules. Hereditary messages were transmitted through a molecule. That molecule could exist in a chemical form outside a cell, and it was capable of carrying information from cell to cell, from organism to organism, and from parents to children. Had Griffith publicized this startling result, he would have set all of biology ablaze. In the 1920s, scientists were just beginning to understand living systems in chemical terms. Biology was becoming chemistry. The cell was a beaker of chemicals, biochemists argued, a pouch of compounds bound by a membrane that were reacting to produce a phenomenon called life. Griffith's identification of a chemical capable of carrying hereditary instructions between organisms, the gene molecule, would have sparked 1,000 speculations and restructured the chemical theory of life. But Griffith, an unassuming, painfully shy scientist, this tiny man who barely spoke above a whisper, could hardly be expected to broadcast the broader relevance or appeal of his results. "Englishmen do everything on principle," George Bernard Shaw once noted, and the principle that Griffith lived by was utter modesty. He lived alone, in a nondescript apartment near his lab in London, and in a spare white modernist cottage that he had built for himself in Brighton. Genes might have moved between organisms, but Griffith could not be forced to travel from his lab to his own lectures. To trick him into giving scientific talks, his friends would stuff him into a taxicab and pay a one-way fare to the destination. In January 1928, after hesitating for months, God is in no hurry, so why should I be? Griffith published his data in the Journal of Hygiene, a scientific journal whose sheer obscurity might have impressed even Mendel. Writing in an abjectly apologetic tone, Griffith seemed genuinely sorry that he had shaken genetics by its roots. His study discussed transformation as a curiosity of microbial biology, but never explicitly mentioned the discovery of a potential chemical basis of heredity. The most important conclusion of the most important biochemical paper of the decade was buried, like a polite cough, under a mound of dense text. Although Frederick Griffith's experiment was the most definitive demonstration that the gene was a chemical, other scientists were also circling the idea. In 1920, Herman Muller, the former student of Thomas Morgan's, moved from New York to Texas to continue studying fly genetics. Like Morgan, Muller hoped to use mutants to understand heredity, but naturally arising mutants, the bread and butter of fruit fly geneticists, were far too rare. The white-eyed or sable-bodied flies that Morgan and his students had discovered in New York had been fished out laboriously by hunting through massive flocks of insects over 30 years. Tired of mutant hunting, Muller wondered if he could accelerate the production of mutants, perhaps by exposing flies to heat or light or higher bursts of energy. In theory, this sounded simple. In practice, it was tricky. When Muller first tried exposing flies to X-rays, he killed them all. Frustrated, he lowered the dose and found that he had now sterilized them. Rather than mutants, he had created vast flocks of dead and then infertile flies. In winter of 1926, acting on a whim, he exposed a cohort of flies to an even lower dose of radiation. He mated the X-rayed males with females and watched the maggots emerge in the milk bottles. Even a cursory look confirmed a striking result. The newly born flies had accumulated mutations, dozens of them, perhaps hundreds. It was late at night, and the only person to receive the breaking news was a lone botanist working on the floor below. Each time Muller found a new mutant, he shouted down from the window, "I got another!" It had taken nearly 3 decades for Morgan and his students to collect about 50 fly mutants in New York. As the botanist noted, with some chagrin, Muller had discovered nearly half that number in a single night. Muller was catapulted into international fame by his discovery. The effect of radiation on the mutation rate in flies had 2 immediate implications. First, genes had to be made of matter. Radiation, after all, is merely energy. Frederick Griffith had made genes move between organisms. Muller had altered genes using energy. A gene, whatever it was capable of motion, transmission, and of energy-induced change, properties generally associated with chemical matter. But more than the material nature of the gene, it was the sheer malleability of the genome. That X-rays could make such silly putty of genes, that stunned scientists. Even Darwin, among the strongest original proponents of the fundamental mutability of nature, would have found this rate of mutation surprising. In Darwin's scheme, the rate of change of an organism was generally fixed, while the rate of natural selection could be amplified to accelerate evolution or dampened to decelerate it. Muller's experiments demonstrated that heredity could be manipulated quite easily. The mutation rate was itself quite mutable. "There is no permanent status quo in nature," Muller later wrote. "All is a process of adjustment and readjustment, or else eventual failure. By altering mutation rates and selecting variants in conjunction, Muller imagined he could possibly push the evolutionary cycle into hyperdrive, even creating entirely new species and subspecies in his laboratory, acting like the lord of his flies." Muller also realized that his experiment had broad implications for human eugenics. If fly genes could be altered with such modest doses of radiation, then could the alteration of human genes be far behind? If genetic alterations could be induced artificially, he wrote, then heredity could no longer be considered the unique privilege of an unreachable god playing pranks on us. Like many scientists and social scientists of his era, Muller had been captivated by eugenics since the 1920s. As an undergraduate, he had formed a biological society at Columbia University to explore and support positive eugenics. But by the late 20s, as he had witnessed the menacing rise of eugenics in the United States, he had begun to reconsider his enthusiasm. The Eugenics Record Office, with its preoccupation with racial purification, and its drive to eliminate immigrants, deviants, and defectives struck him as, frankly, sinister. Its prophets, Davenport, Priddy, and Bell, were weird pseudoscientific creeps. As Mueller thought about the future of eugenics and the possibility of altering human genomes, he wondered whether Galton and his collaborators had made a fundamental conceptual error. Like Galton and Pearson, Mueller sympathized with the desire to use genetics to alleviate suffering. But unlike Galton, Mueller began to realize that positive eugenics was achievable only in a society that had already achieved radical equality. Eugenics could not be the prelude to equality. Instead, equality had to be the precondition for eugenics. Without equality, eugenics would inevitably falter on the false premise that social ills such as vagrancy, pauperism, deviance, alcoholism, and feeble-mindedness were genetic ills, while in fact they merely reflected inequality. Women such as Carrie Buck weren't genetic imbeciles. They were poor, illiterate, unhealthy, and powerless, victims of their social lot, not of the genetic lottery. The Galtonians had been convinced that eugenics would ultimately generate radical equality, transforming the weak into the powerful. Mueller turned that reasoning on its head. Without equality, he argued, eugenics would degenerate into yet another mechanism by which the powerful could control the weak. While Herman Mueller's scientific work was ascending to its zenith in Texas, his personal life was falling apart. His marriage faltered and failed. His rivalry with Bridges and Sturtevant, his former lab partners from Columbia University, reached a brittle endpoint, and his relationship with Morgan, never warm, devolved into icy hostility. Mueller was also hounded for his political proclivities. In New York, he had joined several socialist groups, edited newspapers, recruited students, and befriended the novelist and social activist Theodore Dreiser. In Texas, the rising star of genetics began to edit an underground socialist newspaper, The Spark, after Lenin's Iskra, which promoted civil rights for African Americans, voting rights for women, the education of immigrants, and collective insurance for workers. Hardly radical agendas by contemporary standards, but enough to inflame his colleagues and irk the administration. The FBI launched an investigation into his activities. Newspapers referred to him as a subversive, a commie, a red nut, a Soviet sympathizer, a freak. Isolated, embittered, increasingly paranoid and depressed, Mueller disappeared from his lab one morning and could not be found in his classroom. A search party of graduate students found him hours later, wandering in the woods in the outskirts of Austin. He was walking in a daze, his clothes wrinkled from the drizzle of rain, his face splattered with mud, his shins scratched. He had swallowed a roll of barbiturates in an attempt to commit suicide, but had slept them off by a tree. The next morning, he returned sheepishly to his class. The suicide attempt was unsuccessful, but it was symptomatic of his malaise. Mueller was sick of America, its dirty science, ugly politics, and selfish society. He wanted to escape to a place where he could meld science and socialism more easily. Radical genetic interventions could only be imagined in radically egalitarian societies. In Berlin, he knew, an ambitious liberal democracy with socialist leanings was shedding the husk of its past and guiding the birth of a new republic in the 30s. It was the newest city of the world, Twain had written, a place where scientists, writers, philosophers, and intellectuals were gathering at cafes and salons to forge a free and futuristic society. If the full potential of the modern science of genetics was to be unleashed, Mueller thought, it would be in Berlin. In the winter of 1932, Mueller packed his bags, shipped off several hundred strains of flies, 10,000 glass tubes, 1,000 glass bottles, one microscope, two bicycles, and a 32 Ford, and left for the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin. He had no inkling that his adopted city would indeed witness the unleashing of the new science of genetics, but in its most grisly form in history. Lebens unwertes Leben. Lives unworthy of living. He who is bodily and mentally not sound and deserving may not perpetuate this misfortune in the bodies of his children. The Volkische, people's state, has to perform the most gigantic rearing task here. One day, however, it will appear as a deed greater than the most victorious wars of our present bourgeois era.
Hitler's order for the Action T4. It wanted to be God, to create a new race. Auschwitz prisoner on Josef Mengele's goals. A hereditarily ill person costs 50,000 Reichmarks on average up to the age of 60. Warning to high school students in a Nazi-era German biology textbook. Nazism, the biologist Fritz Lenz once said, is nothing more than applied biology.
In the spring of 1933, as Hermann Müller began his work at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin, he watched Nazi applied biology swing into action. In January that year, Adolf Hitler, the Führer of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, was appointed the Chancellor of Germany. In March, the German Parliament endorsed the Enabling Act, granting Hitler unprecedented power to enact laws without parliamentary involvement. Jubilant Nazi parliamentary troops marched through the streets of Berlin with firelit torches, hailing their victory. Applied biology, as the Nazis understood it, was really applied genetics. Its purpose was to enable Rassenhygiene, racial hygiene. The Nazis were not the first to use the term. Alfred Plätz, the German physician and biologist, had coined the phrase as early as 1895. Recall his sinister, impassioned speech at the International Conference on Eugenics in London in 1912. Racial hygiene, as Plätz described it, was the genetic cleansing of the race, just as personal hygiene was the physical cleaning of the self. And just as personal hygiene routinely purged debris and excrement from the body, racial hygiene eliminated genetic detritus, thereby resulting in the creation of a healthier and purer race. In 1914, Plätz's colleague Heinrich Pohl, the geneticist, wrote, "Just as the organism ruthlessly sacrifices degenerate cells, just as the surgeon ruthlessly removes a diseased organ, both in order to save the whole, so higher organic entities such as the kinship group or the state should not shy away in excessive anxiety from intervening in personal liberty to prevent the bearers of diseased hereditary traits from continuing to spread harmful genes throughout the generations." Plätz and Pohl looked to British and American eugenicists such as Galton, Priddy, and Davenport as pioneers of this new science. The Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded was an ideal experiment in genetic cleansing, they noted. By the early 1920s, as women like Carrie Buck were being identified and carted off to eugenic camps in America, German eugenicists were expanding their own efforts to create a state-sponsored program to confine, sterilize, or eradicate genetically defective men and women. Several professorships of race biology and racial hygiene were established at German universities, and racial science was routinely taught at medical school. The academic hub of race science was the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology, Human Heredity, and Eugenics, a mere stone's throw away from Müller's new lab in Berlin. Hitler, imprisoned for leading the Beer Hall Putsch, the failed coup attempt to seize power in Munich, read about Plätz and race science while jailed in the 1920s and was immediately transfixed. Like Plätz, he believed that defective genes were slow poisoning the nation and obstructing the rebirth of a strong, healthy state. When the Nazis seized power in the 30s, Hitler saw an opportunity to put these ideas into action. He did so immediately. In 1933, less than 5 months after the passage of the Enabling Act, the Nazis enacted the Law for the Prevention of Genetically Diseased Offspring, commonly known as the Sterilization Law. The outlines of the law were explicitly borrowed from the American eugenics program, if amplified for effect. Anyone suffering from a hereditary disease can be sterilized by a surgical operation, the law mandated. An initial list of hereditary diseases was drawn up, including mental deficiency, schizophrenia, epilepsy, depression, blindness, deafness, and serious deformities. To sterilize a man or woman, a state-sponsored application was to be made to the eugenics court. Once the court has decided on sterilization, the law continued, the operation must be carried out even against the will of the person to be sterilized. Where other measures are insufficient, direct force may be used. To drum up public support for the law, legal injunctions were bolstered by insidious propaganda, a formula that the Nazis would eventually bring to monstrous perfection. Films such as Das Erbe, The Inheritance, 1935, and Erbkrank, Hereditary Disease, 1936,
created by the Office of Racial Policy, played to full houses and theaters around the country to showcase the ills of defectives and unfits. In Herb Crank, a mentally ill woman in the throes of a breakdown fiddles repetitively with her hands and hair. A deformed child lies wasted in bed. A woman with shortened limbs walks on all fours like a pack animal. Counterposed against the grim footage of Herb Crank or Das Erbe were cinematic odes to the perfect Aryan body. In Leni Riefenstahl's Olympia, a film intended to celebrate German athletes, glistening young men with muscular bodies demonstrated calisthenics as showpieces of genetic perfection. The audience gawked at the defectives with repulsion and at the superhuman athletes with envy and ambition. While the state-run agitprop machine churned to generate passive consent for eugenic sterilizations, the Nazis ensured that the legal engines were also thrumming to extend the boundaries of racial cleansing. In November 1933, a new law allowed the state to sterilize dangerous criminals, including political dissidents, writers, and journalists, by force. In October 1935, the Nuremberg Laws for the Protection of the Hereditary Health of the German People sought to contain genetic mixing by barring Jews from marrying people of German blood or having sexual relations with anyone of Aryan descent. There was, perhaps, no more bizarre illustration of the conflation between cleansing and racial cleansing than a law that barred Jews from employing German maids in their houses. The vast sterilization and containment programs required the creation of an equally vast administrative apparatus. By 1934, nearly 5,000 adults were being sterilized every month, and 200 hereditary health courts, or genetic courts, had to work full-time to adjudicate appeals against sterilization. Across the Atlantic, American eugenicists applauded the effort, often lamenting their own ill ability to achieve such effective measures. Lothrop Stoddard, another protege of Charles Davenport's, visited one such court in the late 30s and wrote admiringly of its surgical efficacy. On trial during Stoddard's visit was a manic depressive woman, a girl with deaf muteness, a mentally retarded girl, and an ape-like man who had married a Jewess and was apparently also a homosexual. A complete trifecta of crimes. From Stoddard's notes, it remains unclear how the hereditary nature of any of these symptoms was established. Nonetheless, all the subjects were swiftly approved for sterilization. The slip from sterilization to outright murder came virtually unannounced and unnoticed. As early as 1935, Hitler had privately mused about ramping up his gene-cleansing efforts from sterilization to euthanasia. What quicker way to purify the gene pool than to exterminate the defectives? But had been concerned about the public reaction. By the late 1930s, though, the glacial equanimity of the German public response to the sterilization program made the Nazis bolder. Opportunity presented itself in 1939. In the summer of that year, Richard and Lena Kretschmar petitioned Hitler to allow them to euthanize their child, Gerhard. 11 months old, Gerhard had been born blind and with deformed limbs. The parents, ardent Nazis, hoped to service their nation by eliminating their child from the nation's genetic heritage. Sensing his chance, Hitler approved the killing of Gerhard Kretschmar and then moved quickly to expand the program to other children. Working with Karl Brandt, his personal physician, Hitler launched the Scientific Registry of Serious Hereditary and Congenital Illnesses to administer a much larger nationwide euthanasia program to eradicate genetic defectives. To justify the exterminations, the Nazis had already begun to describe the victims using the euphemism Lebenswertes Leben, lives unworthy of living. The eerie phrase conveyed an escalation of the logic of eugenics. It was not enough to sterilize genetic defectives to cleanse the future state. It was necessary to exterminate them to cleanse the current state. This would be a genetic final solution. The killing began with defective children under 3 years of age, but by September 1939, it smoothly expanded to adolescents. Juvenile delinquents were slipped onto the list next. Jewish children were disproportionately targeted, forcibly examined by state doctors, labeled genetically sick, and exterminated, often on the most minor pretexts. By October 1939, the program was expanded to include adults. A richly appointed villa, number 4 Tiergartenstrasse in Berlin, was designated the official headquarters of the euthanasia program. The program would eventually be called Action T4, after that street address. Extermination centers were established around the nation. Particularly active among them was Hadamar, a castle-like hospital on a hill, and the Brandenburg State Welfare Institute, a brick building resembling a garrison with rows of windows along its side. In the basements of these buildings, rooms were refitted into airtight chambers where victims were gassed to death with carbon monoxide. The aura of science and medical research was meticulously maintained, often dramatized to achieve an even greater effect on public imagination. Victims of euthanasia were brought to the extermination centers in buses with screened windows, often accompanied by SS officers in white coats. In rooms adjoining the gas chambers, makeshift concrete beds, surrounded by deep channels to collect fluids, were created, where doctors would dissect the corpses after euthanasia so as to preserve their tissues and brains for future genetic studies. Lives unworthy of living were apparently of extreme worth for the advancement of science. To reassure families that their parents or children had been appropriately treated and triaged, patients were often moved to makeshift holding facilities first, then secretly relocated to Hadamar or Brandenburg for the extermination. After euthanasia, thousands of fraudulent death certificates were issued, citing diverse causes of death, some of them markedly absurd. Mary Rao's mother, who suffered from psychotic depression, was exterminated in 1939. Her family was told that she had died as a consequence of warts on her lip. By 1941, Action T4 had exterminated nearly a quarter of a million men, women, and children. The sterilization law had achieved about 400,000 compulsory sterilizations between 1933 and 1943. Hannah Arendt, the influential cultural critic who documented the perverse excesses of Nazism, would later write about the banality of evil that permeated German culture during the Nazi era. But equally pervasive, it seemed, was the credulity of evil. That Jewishness or gypsiness was carried on chromosomes, transmitted through heredity, and thereby subject to genetic cleansing required a rather extraordinary contortion of belief. But the suspension of skepticism was the defining credo of the culture. Indeed, an entire cadre of scientists, geneticists, medical researchers, psychologists, anthropologists, and linguists gleefully regurgitated academic studies to reinforce the scientific logic of the eugenics program. In a rambling treatise entitled The Racial Biology of Jews, Ottmar von Verschuer, a professor at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin, argued, for instance, that neuroses and hysteria were intrinsic genetic features of Jews. Noting that the suicide rate among Jews had increased by sevenfold between 1849 and 1907, Verschuer concluded, astonishingly, that the underlying cause was not the systematic persecution of Jews in Europe, but their neurotic overreaction to it. Only persons with psychopathic and neurotic tendencies will react in such a manner to such a change in their external condition. In 1936, the University of Munich, an institution richly endowed by Hitler, awarded a Ph.D. to a young medical researcher for his thesis concerning the racial morphology of the human jaw, an attempt to prove that the anatomy of the jaw was racially determined and genetically inherited. The newly minted human geneticist Josef Mengele would soon rise to become the most epically perverse of Nazi researchers, whose experiments on prisoners would earn him the title Angel of Death. In the end, the Nazi program to cleanse the genetically sick was just a prelude to a much larger devastation to come. Horrific as it was, the extermination of the deaf, blind, mute, lame, disabled, and feeble-minded would be numerically eclipsed by the epic horrors ahead, the extermination of 6 million Jews in camps and gas chambers during the Holocaust, of 200,000 gypsies, of several million Soviet and Polish citizens, and unknown numbers of homosexuals, intellectuals, writers, artists, and political dissidents. But it is impossible to separate this apprenticeship in savagery from its fully mature incarnation. It was in this kindergarten of eugenic barbarism that the Nazis learned the alphabets of their trade. The word genocide shares its root with gene, and for good reason. The Nazis used the vocabulary of genes and genetics to launch, justify, and sustain their agenda. The language of genetic discrimination was easily parlayed into the language of racial extermination. The dehumanization of the mentally ill and physically disabled, they cannot think or act like us, was a warm-up act to the dehumanization of Jews. They do not think or act like us. Never before in history, and never with such insidiousness, had genes been so effortlessly conflated with identity, identity with defectiveness, and defectiveness with extermination. Martin Niemöller, the German theologian, summarized the slippery march of evil in his often quoted statement, "First they came for socialists, and I did not speak out, because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out, because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out, because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me." As the Nazis were learning to twist the language of heredity to prop up a state-sponsored program of sterilization and extermination in the 1930s, another powerful European state was also contorting the logic of heredity and genes to justify its political agenda, although in precisely the opposite manner. The Nazis had embraced genetics as a tool for racial cleansing. In the Soviet Union in the 1930s, left-wing scientists and intellectuals proposed that nothing about heredity was inherent at all. In nature, everything, everyone, was changeable. Genes were a mirage invented by the bourgeoisie to emphasize the fixity of individual differences, whereas, in fact, nothing about features, identities, choices, or destinies was indelible. If the state needed cleansing, it would not be achieved through genetic selection, but through the re-education of all individuals and the erasure of former selves. Brains, not genes, had to be washed clean. As with the Nazis, the Soviet doctrine was also bolstered and reinforced by ersatz science. In 1928, an austere, stone-faced agricultural researcher named Trofim Lysenko, he gives one the feeling of a toothache, one journalist wrote, claimed that he had found a way to shatter and reorient hereditary influences in animals and plants. In experiments performed on remote Siberian farms, Lysenko had supposedly exposed wheat strains to severe bouts of cold and drought, and thereby caused the strains to acquire a hereditary resistance to adversity. Lysenko's claims would later be found to be either frankly fraudulent or based on experiments of the poorest scientific quality. By treating wheat strains with such shock therapy, Lysenko argued that he could make the plants flower more vigorously in the spring and yield higher bounties of grain through the summer. Shock therapy was obviously at odds with genetics. The exposure of wheat to cold or drought could no more produce permanent heritable changes in its genes than the serial dismemberment of mice's tails could create a tailless mouse strain, or the stretching of an antelope's neck could produce a giraffe. To instill such a change in his plants, Lysenko would have had to mutate cold-resistant genes, a la Morgan or Muller, use natural or artificial selection to isolate mutant strains, a la Darwin, and crossbreed mutant strains with each other to fix the mutation, a la Mendel and DeVries. But Lysenko convinced himself and his Soviet bosses that he had retrained the crops through exposure and conditioning alone, and thereby altered their inherent characteristics. He dismissed the notion of genes altogether. The gene, he argued, had been invented by geneticists to support a rotting, moribund bourgeoisie science. The hereditary basis does not lie in some special self-reproducing substance. It was a hoary restatement of Lamarck's idea of adaptation morphing directly into hereditary change, decades after geneticists had pointed out the conceptual errors of Lamarckism. Lysenko's theory was immediately embraced by the Soviet political apparatus. It promised a new method to vastly increase agricultural production in a land teetering on the edge of famine. By re-educating wheat and rice, crops could be grown under any conditions, including the severest winters and the driest summers. Perhaps just as important, Stalin and his compatriots found the prospect of shattering and retraining genes via shock therapy satisfying ideologically. While Lysenko was retraining plants to relieve them of their dependencies on soil and climate, Soviet party workers were also re-educating political dissidents to relieve them of their ingrained dependence on false consciousness and material goods. The Nazis, believing in absolute genetic immutability, a Jew is a Jew, had resorted to eugenics to change the structure of their population. The Soviets, believing in absolute genetic reprogrammability, anyone is everyone, could eradicate all distinctions and thus achieve a radical collective good. In 1940, Lysenko deposed his critics, assumed the directorship of the Institute of Genetics of the Soviet Union, and set up his own totalitarian fiefdom over Soviet biology. Any form of scientific dissent to his theories, especially any belief in Mendelian genetics or Darwinian evolution, was outlawed in the Soviet Union. Scientists were sent to gulags to retrain them in Lysenko's ideas. As with wheat, the exposure of dissident professors to shock therapy might convince them to change their minds. In August 1940, Nikolai Vavilov, a renowned Mendelian geneticist, was captured and sent to the notorious Saratov jail for propagating his bourgeoisie views on biology. Vavilov had dared to argue that genes were not so easily malleable. While Vavilov and other geneticists languished in prison, Lysenko's supporters launched a vigorous campaign to discredit genetics as a science. In January 1943, exhausted and malnourished, Vavilov was moved to a prison hospital. "I am nothing but dung now," he described himself to his captors, and died a few weeks later. Nazism and Lysenkoism were based on dramatically opposed conceptions of heredity. But the parallels between the two movements are striking. Although Nazi doctrine was unsurpassed in its virulence, both Nazism and Lysenkoism shared a common thread. In both cases, a theory of heredity was used to construct a notion of human identity that, in turn, was contorted to serve a political agenda. The two theories of heredity may have been spectacularly opposite. The Nazis were as obsessed with the fixity of identity as the Soviets were with its complete pliability. But the language of genes and inheritance was central to statehood and progress. It is as difficult to imagine Nazism without a belief in the indelibility of inheritance as it is to conceive of a Soviet state without a belief in its perfect erasure. Unsurprisingly, in both cases, science was deliberately distorted to support state-sponsored mechanisms of cleansing. By appropriating the language of genes and inheritance, entire systems of power and statehood were justified and reinforced. By the mid-20th century, the gene, or the denial of its existence, had already emerged as a potent political and cultural tool. It had become one of the most dangerous ideas in history. Junk science props up totalitarian regimes, and totalitarian regimes produce junk science. Did the Nazi geneticists make any real contributions to the science of genetics? Amid the voluminous chaff, two contributions stand out. The first was methodological. Nazi scientists advanced the twin study, although characteristically they soon morphed it into a ghastly form. Twin studies had originated in Francis Galton's work in the 1890s. Having coined the phrase nature versus nurture, Galton had wondered how a scientist might discern the influence of one over the other. How could one determine if any particular feature, height or intelligence, say, was the product of nature or nurture? How could one unbraid heredity and environment? Galton proposed piggybacking on a natural experiment. Since twins share identical genetic material, he reasoned, any substantial similarities between them could be attributed to genes, while any differences were the consequence of environment. By studying twins and comparing and contrasting similarities and differences, a geneticist could determine the precise contributions of nature versus nurture to important traits. Galton was on the right track, except for a crucial flaw. He had not distinguished between identical twins who are truly genetically identical and fraternal twins who are merely genetic siblings. Identical twins are derived from the splitting of a single fertilized egg, thereby resulting in twins with identical genomes, while fraternal twins are derived from the simultaneous fertilization of two eggs by two sperm, thereby resulting in twins with non-identical genomes. Early twin studies were thus confounded by this confusion, leading to inconclusive results. In 1924, Hermann Werner Siemens, the German eugenicist and Nazi sympathizer, proposed a twin study that advanced Galton's proposal by meticulously separating identical twins from fraternal twins. A dermatologist by training, Siemens was a student of Pletz's and a vociferous early proponent of racial hygiene. Like Pletz, Siemens realized that genetic cleansing could be justified only if scientists could first establish heredity. You could justify sterilizing a blind man only if you could establish that his blindness was inherited. For traits such as hemophilia, this was straightforward. One hardly needed twin studies to establish heredity. But for complex traits, such as intelligence or mental illness, the establishment of heredity was vastly more complex. To deconvolute the effects of heredity and environment, Seaman suggested comparing fraternal twins to identical twins. The key test of heredity would be concordance. The term concordance refers to the fraction of twins who possess a trait in common. If twins share eye color 100% of the time, then the concordance is 1. If they share it 50% of the time, then the concordance is 0.5. Concordance is a convenient measure for whether genes influence a trait. If identical twins possess a strong concordance for schizophrenia, say, while fraternal twins born and bred in an identical environment show little concordance, then the roots of that illness can be firmly attributed to genetics. For Nazi geneticists, these early studies provided the fuel for more drastic experiments. The most vigorous proponent of such experiments was Josef Mengele, the anthropologist turned physician turned SS officer who, sheathed in a white coat, haunted the concentration camps at Auschwitz and Birkenau. Morbidly interested in genetics and medical research, Mengele rose to become physician-in-chief at Auschwitz, where he unleashed a series of monstrous experiments on twins. Between 1943 and 1945, more than 1,000 twins were subjected to Mengele's experiments. Egged on by his mentor, Otmar von Verschuer, from Berlin, Mengele sought out twins for his studies by trawling through the ranks of incoming camp prisoners and shouting a phrase that would become etched into the memories of the camp dwellers. Zwillinge heraus, twins out. Or Zwillinge heraus straighten, twins step out. Yanked off the ramps, the twins were marked by special tattoos, housed in separate blocks, and systematically victimized by Mengele and his assistants. Ironically, as experimental subjects, twins were also more likely to survive the camp than non-twin children, who were more casually exterminated. Mengele obsessively measured their body parts to compare genetic influences on growth. "There isn't a piece of body that wasn't measured and compared," one twin recalled. "We were always sitting together, always nude." Other twins were murdered by gassing and their bodies dissected to compare the sizes of internal organs. Yet others were killed by the injection of chloroform into the heart. Some were subjected to unmatched blood transfusions, limb amputations, or operations without anesthesia. Twins were infected with typhus to determine genetic variations in the responses to bacterial infections. In a particularly horrific example, a pair of twins, one with a hunched back, were sewn together surgically to determine if a shared spine would correct the disability. The surgical site turned gangrenous, and both twins died shortly after. Despite the ersatz patina of science, Mengele's work was of the poorest scientific quality. Having subjected hundreds of victims to experiments, he produced no more than a scratched, poorly annotated notebook with no noteworthy results. One researcher examining the disjointed notes at the Auschwitz Museum concluded, "No scientist could take them seriously." Indeed, whatever early advances in twin studies were achieved in Germany, Mengele's experiments putrefied twin research so effectively, pickling the entire field in such hatred, that it would take decades for the world to take it seriously. The second contribution of the Nazis to genetics was never intended as a contribution. By the mid-1930s, as Hitler ascended to power in Germany, droves of scientists sensed the rising menace of the Nazi political agenda and left the country. Germany had dominated science in the early 20th century. It had been the crucible of atomic physics, quantum mechanics, nuclear chemistry, physiology, and biochemistry. Of the 100 Nobel Prizes awarded in physics, chemistry, and medicine between 1901 and 1932, 33 were awarded to German scientists. The British received 18, the Americans only 6. When Hermann Muller arrived in Berlin in 1932, the city was home to the world's preeminent scientific minds. Einstein was writing equations on the chalkboards of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute of Physics. Otto Hahn, the chemist, was breaking apart atoms to understand their constituent subatomic particles. Hans Krebs, the biochemist, was breaking open cells to identify their constituent chemical components. But the ascent of Nazism sent an immediate chill through the German scientific establishment.
In April 1933, Jewish professors were abruptly evicted from their positions in state-funded universities. Sensing imminent danger, thousands of Jewish scientists migrated to foreign countries. Einstein left for a conference in 1933 and wisely declined to return. Krebs fled that same year, as did the biochemist Ernest Chain and physiologist Wilhelm Feldberg. Max Perutz, the physicist, moved to Cambridge University in 1937. For some non-Jews, such as Erwin Schrödinger and nuclear chemist Max Delbruck, the situation was morally untenable. Many resigned out of disgust and moved to foreign countries. Hermann Müller, disappointed by another false utopia, left Berlin for the Soviet Union on yet another quest to unite science and socialism. Lest we misconstrue the response of scientists to Nazi ascendancy, let it be known that many German scientists maintained a deadly silence in response to Nazism. Hitler may have ruined the long-term prospects of German science, George Orwell wrote in 1945, but there was no dearth of gifted German men to do necessary research on such things as synthetic oil, jet planes, rocket projectiles, and the atomic bomb. Germany's loss was genetics' gain. The exodus from Germany allowed scientists to travel not just between nations, but also between disciplines. Finding themselves in new countries, they also found an opportunity to turn their attention to novel problems. Atomic physicists were particularly interested in biology. It was the unexplored frontier of scientific inquiry. Having reduced matter into its fundamental units, they sought to reduce life to similar material units. The ethos of atomic physics, the relentless drive to find irreducible particles, universal mechanisms, and systematic explanations would soon permeate biology and drive the discipline toward new methods and new questions. The reverberations of this ethos would be felt for decades to come. As physicists and chemists drifted toward biology, they attempted to understand living beings in chemical and physical terms through molecules, forces, structures, actions, and reactions. In time, these émigrés to the new continent would redraw its maps. Genes drew the most attention. What were genes made of, and how did they function? Morgan's work had pinpointed their location on chromosomes, where they were supposedly strung like beads on a wire. Griffith's and Muller's experiments had pointed to a material substance, a chemical, that could move between organisms and was quite easily altered by X-rays. Biologists might have blanched at trying to describe the gene molecule on purely hypothetical grounds, but what physicist could resist taking a ramble in weird, risky territory? In 1944, speaking in Dublin, the quantum theorist Erwin Schrödinger audaciously attempted to describe the molecular nature of the gene based on purely theoretical principles, a lecture later published as the book What is Life? The gene, Schrödinger posited, had to be made of a particular kind of chemical. It had to be a molecule of contradictions. It had to possess chemical regularity. Otherwise, routine processes such as copying and transmission would not work. But it also had to be capable of extraordinary irregularity, or else the enormous diversity of inheritance could not be explained. The molecule had to be able to carry vast amounts of information, yet be compact enough to be packaged into cells. Schrödinger imagined a chemical with multiple chemical bonds stretching out along the length of the chromosome fiber. Perhaps the sequence of bonds encoded the code script, a variety of contents compressed into some miniature code. Perhaps the order of beads on the string carried the secret code of life. Similarity and difference, order and diversity, message and matter. Schrödinger was trying to conjure up a chemical that would capture the divergent, contradictory qualities of heredity. A molecule to satisfy Aristotle. In his mind's eye, it was almost as if he had seen DNA. That stupid molecule. Never underestimate the power of stupidity. Robert Heinlein. Oswald Avery was 55 in 1933 when he heard of Frederick Griffith's transformation experiment. His appearance made him seem even older than his years. Frail, small, bespectacled, balding, with a bird-like voice and limbs that hung like twigs in winter. Avery was a professor at the Rockefeller University in New York, where he had spent a lifetime studying bacteria.
particularly pneumococcus.
He was sure that Griffith had made some terrible mistake in his experiment. How could chemical debris carry genetic information from one cell to another?
Like musicians, like mathematicians, like elite athletes, scientists peak early and dwindle fast. It isn't creativity that fades, but stamina. Science is an endurance sport. To produce that single illuminating experiment, 1,000 non-illuminating experiments have to be sent into the trash. It is a battle between nature and nerve. Avery had established himself as a competent microbiologist, but had never imagined venturing into the new world of genes and chromosomes. The Fess, as his students affectionately called him, short for professor, was a good scientist, but unlikely to become a revolutionary one. Griffith's experiment may have stuffed genetics into a one-way taxicab and sent it scuttling toward a strange future, but Avery was reluctant to climb on that bandwagon.
If the Fess was a reluctant geneticist, then DNA was a reluctant gene molecule.
Griffith's experiment had generated widespread speculations about the molecular identity of the gene. By the early 1940s, biochemists had broken cells apart to reveal their chemical constituents and identified various molecules in living systems, but the molecule that carried the code of heredity was still unknown. Chromatin, the biological structure where genes resided, was known to be made of two types of chemicals, proteins and nucleic acids. No one knew or understood the chemical structure of chromatin, but of the two intimately mixed components, proteins were vastly more familiar to biologists, vastly more versatile, and vastly more likely to be gene carriers. Proteins were known to carry out the bulk of functions in the cell. Cells depend on chemical reactions to live. During respiration, for instance, sugar combines chemically with oxygen to make carbon dioxide and energy. None of these reactions occur spontaneously. If they did, our bodies would be constantly ablaze with the smell of flambéed sugar. Proteins coax and control these fundamental chemical reactions in the cell, speeding some and slowing others, pacing the reactions just enough to be compatible with living. Life may be chemistry, but it's a special circumstance of chemistry. Organisms exist not because of reactions that are possible, but because of reactions that are barely possible. Too much reactivity and we would spontaneously combust, too little and we would turn cold and die. Proteins enable these barely possible reactions, allowing us to live on the edges of chemical entropy, skating perilously but never falling in. Proteins also form the structural components of the cell, filaments of hair, nails, cartilage, or the matrices that trap and tether cells. Twisted into yet other shapes, they also form receptors, hormones, and signaling molecules, allowing cells to communicate with one another. Nearly every cellular function, metabolism, respiration, cell division, self-defense, waste disposal, secretion, signaling, growth, even cellular death, requires proteins. They are the workhorses of the biochemical world. Nucleic acids, in contrast, were the dark horses of the biochemical world. In 1869, 4 years after Mendel had read his paper to the Brno Society, a Swiss biochemist, Friedrich Miescher, had discovered this new class of molecules and cells. Like most of his biochemist colleagues, Miescher was also trying to classify the molecular components of cells by breaking cells apart and separating the chemicals that were released. Of the various components, he was particularly intrigued by one kind of chemical. He had precipitated it in dense, swirling strands out of white blood cells that he had wrung out of human pus and surgical dressings. He had found the same white swirl of a chemical in salmon sperm. He called the molecule nucleon because it was concentrated in a cell's nucleus. Since the chemical was acidic, its name was later modified to nucleic acids, but the cellular function of nucleon had remained mysterious. By the early 1920s, biochemists had acquired a deeper understanding of the structure of nucleic acids. The chemical came in two forms, DNA and RNA, molecular cousins. Both were long chains made of four components, called bases, strung together along a string-like chain or backbone. The four bases protruded out from the backbone, like leaves emerging out of the tendril of ivy. In DNA, the four leaves, or bases, were adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. abbreviated A, G, C, and T. In RNA, the thymine was switched into uracil, hence A, C, G, and U. Beyond these rudimentary details, nothing was known about the structure or function of DNA and RNA. To the biochemist Phoebus Levine, one of Avery's colleagues at Rockefeller University, the comically plain chemical composition of DNA, four bases strung along a chain, suggested an extremely unsophisticated structure. DNA must be a long, monotonous polymer, Levine reasoned. In Levine's mind, the four bases were repeated in a defined order. AGCT, 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 and so forth ad nauseam. Repetitive, rhythmic, regular, austere, this was a conveyor belt of a chemical, the nylon of the biochemical world. Levine called it a stupid molecule. Even a cursory look at Levine's proposed structure for DNA disqualified it as a carrier of genetic information. Stupid molecules could not carry clever messages. Monotonous to the extreme, DNA seemed to be quite the opposite of Schrödinger's imagined chemical. Not just a stupid molecule, but worse, a boring one. In contrast, proteins, diverse, chatty, versatile, capable of assuming zealot-like shapes and performing zealot-like functions, were infinitely more attractive as gene carriers. If chromatin, as Morgan had suggested, was a string of beads, then proteins had to be the active component, the beads, while DNA was likely the string. The nucleic acid in a chromosome, as one biochemist put it, was merely the structure-determining, supporting substance, a glorified molecular scaffold for genes. Proteins carried the real stuff of heredity. DNA was the stuffing. In the spring of 1940, Avery confirmed the key result of Griffith's experiment. He separated the crude bacterial debris from the virulent smooth strain, mixed it with the live bacteria of the non-virulent rough strain, and injected the mix into mice. Smooth-coated, virulent bacteria emerged faithfully and killed the mice. The transforming principle had worked. Like Griffith, Avery observed that the smooth-coated bacteria, once transformed, retained their virulence generation upon generation. In short, genetic information must have been transmitted between two organisms in a purely chemical form, allowing that transition from the rough-coated to the smooth-coated variant. But what chemical? Avery fiddled with the experiment as only a microbiologist could, growing the bacteria in various cultures, adding beef heart broth, removing contaminant sugars, and growing the colonies on plates. Two assistants, Colin McLeod and Macklin McCarty, joined his laboratory to help with the experiments. The early technical fussing was crucial. By early August, the three had achieved the transformation reaction in a flask and distilled the transforming principle into a highly concentrated form. By October 1940, they began to sift through the concentrated bacterial detritus, painstakingly separating each chemical component and testing each fraction for its capacity to transmit genetic information. First, they removed all the remaining fragments of the bacterial coat from the debris. The transforming activity remained intact. They dissolved the lipids in alcohol, but there was no change in transformation. They stripped away the proteins by dissolving the material in chloroform. The transforming principle was untouched. They digested the proteins with various enzymes. The activity remained unaltered. They heated the material to 65 degrees, hot enough to warp most proteins, then added acids to curdle the proteins, and the transmission of genes was still unaltered. The experiments were meticulous, exhaustive, and definitive. Whatever its chemical constituents, the transforming principle was not composed of sugars, lipids, or proteins. What was it, then? It could be frozen and thawed. Alcohol precipitated it. It settled out of solution in a white, fibrous substance that wraps itself about a glass rod like a thread on a spool. Had Avery placed the fibrous spool on his tongue, he might have tasted the faint sourness of the acid, followed by the aftertaste of sugar and the metallic note of salt. Like the taste of the primordial sea, as one writer described it. An enzyme that digested RNA had no effect. The only way to eradicate transformation was to digest the material with an enzyme that, of all things, degraded DNA. DNA,